Welcome to Cisco Tech Beat, the podcast that explores the people and stories behind what inspires the newest innovation. I'm your host, AB, and I'm really excited for today's episode because I am talking with my newest Cisco friend, Tazeen Khan, known affectionately as Taz, who is a guru on cybersecurity and also happens to co-host Cisco's Security Stories podcast, which, like Tech Beat, can be found on pretty much every major podcast platform. So, Taz, without further ado, welcome to the show.
Hello. I'm pumped. Thanks for having me.
Of course, of course. And, you know, when we set the show up, we knew that we were going to talk security, but I want to know more about you because we haven't really met in person yet and there's a lot to learn. So if you don't mind, just give me a little bit of a background. Where are you from? What's your background? And how did you first get interested in the world of cybersecurity?
Okay. It's hard because, you know, we get older and we realize that our backgrounds are really far back. And where do you even begin, honestly? But I'm Tazeen. I'm originally from Bangladesh and grew up in Queens, New York City, and then kind of moved around and whatnot. And my way into the cybersecurity industry was pretty unorthodox, but I had no interest in this industry, to be quite honest. My interest grew over time, but I was working at a Michael Kors and I had three jobs. I was in school and there was a woman that walked in and she looked fly. All right. Her man was carrying her bags. She had like Prada, Gucci, all of the things. And I'm like 18 looking at her. What do you do and how do I do it? So I helped her out. We had really great conversation. And, you know, she told me she was in cybersecurity sales. And I told her, well, that's what I want to do. And I need you to help me do it. I emailed her every month for about 6 months until she hired me. And I got my way into a government contracting firm called Immix Group. That was where my security career started. And I was an account manager. And from there, I just continued to move through, you know, different roles, but was in sales. And in my sales experience, I realized I really like this nerdy stuff. I love the technical aspects of security. I'm quite good at it. And then I moved into some more technical positions. I started consulting and then dove into a compliance role, worked on an incidents response team. And now I'm here and I do marketing adjacent work at Cisco. So that's been kind of the, you know, the past 12 years, I guess, of my career and where we're at. But I really became interested, honestly, in the industry more recently, in 2017. I think in the beginning it was a job. And then it became this thing where I'm realizing that there's so much more impact and it really is rooted in social justice in a lot of ways. And that's something that is so near and dear to my heart. But yeah, that's kind of where the passion began.
I love that. It's funny with the social justice topic because, you know, I was talking to G2 about the security poverty line and, you know, and it's just interesting. I mean, social justice is something that really transcends everything. I mean, it's found in innovation. It's found in security, in purpose. So it's pretty interesting that you mentioned that. And the other thing that you mentioned, which is interesting, is that your path to cybersecurity is one that is a lot more common than people think, because there's this misconception around security in general and cybersecurity that in order to do this kind of job, you have to be super trained and you go to the best school and you have this particular degree. And that's just not really the case at all, right?
No, not at all. I feel that, like you said, more people get into this industry in an unorthodox way. And it depends. There are so many roles. I think that there are misconceptions about the security industry. People will assume, you know, the hackers with the hoodies and you have to be a programmer. But if you think of any industry or any organization, you just think about the ecosystem behind it and you need roles for everything, right? From administrative, project management, marketing, sales, and each of those departments have even more granularity against it. And then in the security field itself, you know, people will say, I want to get into cybersecurity. And there's so much that you can do. There's so many different verticals within the cybersecurity industry. But yeah, most of the people that I talk to in the Security Stories podcast too, like a lot of them have these unorthodox stories of how they kind of happened in to the industry as opposed to folks that went to school for it. I mean, honestly, they're the cybersecurity majors are very recent. Even when I went to school 10 years ago, cybersecurity was not a major that you could do computer science, but there wasn't a scope for cybersecurity. So
right,
it's new. Yeah, it's pretty new.
So for anyone listening out there, and if you're in school for it, that's great. But if you're not, do not be deterred thinking that you have to have X, Y, and Z lined up so that you can become a cybersecurity specialist. You know, there's so many ways in. And as Taz mentioned, there's so many roles. Mm-hmm. It's not a one size fits all approach. So definitely a lot of opportunity out there. I want to go back and double down a little bit more on social justice, because I know that in 2019, you founded Cyber Collective, which I believe at the time, and maybe still, was the only woman of color owned and operated community-centered research organization focusing mostly on data ethics, privacy, cybersecurity research, and a whole lot more. What was the catalyst for your creating that, and how has that experience informed the work that you do even today at Cisco?
Wow, that's a great question. Yes, I haven't done enough research to know if there are more orgs that have popped up around. I'm hoping that there are. At the time, unfortunately, there weren't. And we have shifted. We're doing less research now. We started working with UCLA Center for Critical Internet Inquiry. You know, we partnered with a lot of different universities and institutions, but we focus more heavily on education and awareness. And I think our research really helps set the impetus to that shift. We are translators. It was a point of translation on two separate stories that really started Cyber Collective. One, my dad got hacked, and it was around 2019 that he did. And he had a hard time understanding the multi-factor authentication, or not multi-factor, but just the authentication system. Uh-huh. You know, he got hacked. I told him, I was like, Baba, you got to change the security answers, like the answers to your security questions, call your banks and stuff. And he said, how am I going to do that? They are going to know that I'm changing them. I was like, what do you mean? I was like, just lie to them, like change something. Like, because what my father didn't understand is a lot of the answers that we give to those more or so antiquated security questions, that is no longer private information. That information is available on the internet. So high school mascot, mother's maiden name, first street that you ever lived on. And so I'd told my dad, change it and lie and make something up. My father thought that the bank had access to those answers and that if he changed it, that he would get penalized for it. Now, you know, my dad is a incredible human being, incredibly intelligent, a freedom fighter and Bangladeshi. We came to this country like on political asylum. And so, you know,
right.
A lot of people make assumptions. Well, like, is your dad educated? Which is also a pretty not so nice thing to assume for folks when I tell that story. It's just that's how far removed people are from understanding this authentication process. And even though that's his singular story, it cannot be his experience alone. Learned through my work that it's not. So that was one thing. And I had to explain to him, and I'm like, damn, people really don't understand how to remain secure. And they really don't understand the ins and outs of simpler, quote unquote, parts of security and let's call digital hygiene. That's really important. So that was one part of the story. And then the other was I was consulting into this organization, an insurance company to be specific, and there was a security awareness program that they had to implement, and it didn't do so well, right? The awareness wasn't really landing. And it was a gentleman who, to his defense, is not a teacher. He was not meant to give presentations. He was a guy in IT that didn't sign up to have to educate people on cybersecurity hygiene and awareness. And so they brought me in after the awareness wasn't doing so hot, and I helped create a new program. I gave a presentation, and it was in that moment that I realized I'm actually pretty good at translating some of this complex information into simple language. And those two experiences coupled together set this initiative for me where I thought, I want to help people. I want to help the babas of the world. I want to help the people that are going into work every day for their livelihood. It was an insurance company in New Jersey. So most of the women were of all different ethnicities and cultures that are just trying to go to work and take care of their families here and probably their families in another country.
That's right.
And they were being penalized. If you didn't follow, if you ended up failing any of the kind of security awareness phishing tests that were given, they were trying to implement a 3 strikes, you're out program. And if you fail, you get fired because of the amount of fines that these insurance companies or financial services companies have to adhere to. So right. Where's the gap? How do you essentially, you know, it's the chicken and the egg kind of conversation. Like, what do we do? There are liabilities within a security kind of infrastructure, but also is it their fault? And this was a long time ago. I think security awareness and simple language is very new in our industries, but that's really what set it off. And so then I started making content, videos, and hosting workshops. And 3 years later, I guess almost 4 years later, we are still standing and doing well. I'm excited.
That's such a great story and such a great cause. And yes, I can relate to the parents. I mean, listen, I have enough trouble helping parents and other relatives who are older with basic computer stuff. So you can only imagine right. the need when it comes to cybersecurity. I want to talk about, you mentioned women in particular in the scenario that you worked in, but in general, like all things equality and social justice related, especially here at Cisco, we celebrate women every day. And in fact, I know you're aware of this, but at the end of last year, we partnered with the Female Quotient to learn about sort of the impact that tech has on resilience for women mm-hmm. during their career. And the results of the study were pretty eye-opening. I just want to ask you, embracing that theme of resilience, what does resilience mean to you? And, you know, what do you feel are the most pressing issues in resilience among women in the workforce today, particularly in tech?
How much time do we have? No.
As long as you want.
In full transparency, I think it depends on the day. Resilience is one of those words where it's a spectrum. I don't think that it is something that I can be every single day. Perhaps other people it might be. But if I were to find some pillars of resilience that are important to me, authenticity is one of them. Mm-hmm. Can I be mm-hmm. myself? Can I show up as I am? Can I be vulnerable in who I am and the things that I'm experiencing? You know, you can show up vulnerable. You can give critical feedback rooted in compassion to other people and be able to help the outcomes and impact of whatever you're working on if you feel strong in your resilience. I wish that we didn't have the systems and infrastructure in place that force people to have to be a little more resilient than perhaps in, you know, other places in the world. They don't have to be. It's a little bit more right. relaxed than where we are on this side of the world. Yeah, authenticity, I think, is what resilience means to me personally. I really struggled with, I've always been this way. You know, I think I have a lot more tact, but being authentic was not cool early mm-hmm. on in my career. Being vulnerable was not cool early on right. in my career. And now you can go somewhere and say, you know, hey, I'm experiencing X and it's leading to Y. And I hope that you can understand that and people are a lot more open to these things, especially the human elements of life. And so I appreciate where we are today. And related right. to the second question of what are the most pressing issues in resilience among women in the workforce, you know, at least people, however you identify with being a woman and what that means to folks. But for me personally, some of these most pressing issues is how much unseen labor women are carrying on a daily basis. We're resilient on so many different layers and facets of our lives that the workforce doesn't always see, but then expects us to be able to show up in full capacity, right? Everyone has their different relationship with the word woman. They have different relationships with what it means to be one or show up as one. Speaking for myself, being a woman means divine femininity. And so this is going into a whole other topic of conversation, but I come from a very matriarchal family. And so the women are leading a lot. We're leading the direction of our household. We are leading the conversations around the table. What are the kids thinking about doing? You know, there's so many things. And this question is hard to answer, honestly, because I am afraid of offending people. And I hope that I can be vulnerable and authentic in how I'm showing up in this dialogue of, I don't want my perspective of what it means to be resilient as a woman to negate or take away from anybody. I think it's a conversation of adding on. I can only really answer to my experiences as an individual. I think that there are a lot of antiquated frameworks of what we think or believe it means to be a woman or show up as a woman. And I think it would behoove us to expand on that language and that scope and perspective. And that will help the resiliency. I think that will help, again, with my original answer, being authentic.
I appreciate that. And I think, you know, it's always refreshing when people can be their authentic selves. And to your point, regardless of how you identify, we're talking about women right now specifically, but you're right, to be able to be authentic, to identify a certain way, to come to the table with whatever it is that you deal with as a person. I love that answer because, like you said, you're being yourself. Lots of people are going to be themselves. And hopefully over time, there'll be more openness to that authenticity. So I appreciate that. We're going to jump totally to a different subject now because diving back into security a little bit, when we first met online, that sounded weird. It wasn't Match.com, people. Don't worry about that. It was WebEx.
When we first met in an AIM chat room.
That's right. When we first talked via WebEx, We very briefly covered the topic of silos, specifically security silos, and we didn't get deep into it, but I guess the general idea was sometimes we get so hyper-focused on security that we stay in that lane without sometimes opening up a little bit to see some of these other subject areas or disciplines that could also lend themselves to the whole conversation about security. I wanted to dive into that a little bit more about the silos and kind of what you meant by that.
So before I answer that question, I do want to give a little bit of background because I have been in the security industry for a really long time, but I am a super nerd. I read a lot. I'm very interested in a lot of different subject matters. And I think that that diversity in information has helped the way I come to the table, especially as a translator. And that's kind of what I call myself now. I studied ethics in school and in my undergrad. And, you know, I'm getting my master's at NYU. I'm studying cybersecurity, global security, and cybercrime. And it's at the intersection of global affairs and cybersecurity. And how does cybersecurity relate to international affairs and how we look at security for physical security as people or digital security and the security of like global infrastructure itself.
Right.
Through my work, Cyber Collective, I have a huge focus on ethics and a subject called digital sociology, and essentially is at the intersection of the internet and society. And how is the internet reshaping and framing the way that we make decisions? And how does that now impact these very long-standing frameworks that exist that were created without the internet in mind? There's a really incredible book written by Dr. Jesse Daniels and a couple of other professors called Digital Sociologies. I highly recommend it. It's a textbook. I read it in 3 days, but it was so interesting. That should give to the nerd. So I give that information and that background to kind of show where I'm coming from when I give this answer. So I'm embedded in a lot of different worlds. I feel like I live multiple lives and have multiple identities. Because when you talk to folks in the cybersecurity industry, again, like we talked about, cybersecurity is a galaxy within itself, right? In a galaxy, there are so many things. you know, you have to look at the entire scope. There's a universe in a galaxy. There are planets, stars, right? Solar systems, all of these things that are in a galaxy. And that's, you can look at the cybersecurity industry as a galaxy. Then you have the privacy industry. Then you have the data, you know, and data is kind of at the center of all of these conversations that we're having in a way, both on the cybersecurity side and a privacy side, sociological side, whatever ology side you want right. to kind of touch on. But all of these subject matters are galaxies. And in the experience that I've had is that folks are really, there's an expert bias within each industry. And we have started bridging the gap between many conversations and subject matters, but there's a long way to go. What I love about what we're doing at Cisco in our dialogue around like security resilience or, you know, our security outcomes report, what G2, you know, our leadership is working on, our advisory CISOs, you know, Wendy Nather, Helen Patton, so many incredibly intelligent people, they come to the table, I believe, with a lot of these other subjects in mind. And that was kind of what I meant around the silos as we look deeper, right? A security analyst may not be aware of the ethical implications of the tool that they're working on. And the biggest piece that we're seeing just in technology at large is what are the downstream impacts of what we're doing? What are the unintended consequences of what we're building, creating, securing? And there is a lot to consider. We have to consider, obviously, everything from a cybersecurity, you know, confidentiality, integrity, availability, the going back to the framework of things. But then from a privacy perspective, are we as security professionals really well versed in what's happening around privacy laws, around regulation, and how does that impact the way that we secure tools or vice versa? Do privacy folks understand enough about the importance of security? And then you think of ethics, and that is my jam. You know, tech ethics is so important. And I think that everybody has a different background, has different political culture, socioeconomic background. And no one person's set of ethics can be the foundation or the benchmark. So where do we go from there? How do we determine what ethical standards can be the benchmark to help us build a better future where technology is a force for good for all? I don't have the answer to that. In the work that we do at Cyber Collective, we help people think critically about their relationship with technology and help give them enough information to build agency. And I think that that's the root of all of this, like helping people build agency against different subjects. And it's no longer enough to just know your, you know, if you're a cloud security engineer, just to know what's working within your scope, we have to expand because everything is interconnected. I know that's a really long-winded answer to this question, but that it is. And I don't feel that there's a way to really shorten it. And the other thing that I think is happening too is that we're trying to have conversations about very vast and in-depth subjects that require deep learning, and we're matching it against the attention economy, which is an entirely, that's where the digital sociology stuff comes into play. Like, how does the attention economy impact the way that we secure technology and the way that people are making decisions on the internet? There's a lot to consider. I know I kind of touched on a million different things, but if anybody is interested in furthering like the dialogue around this, hit me up, read our research at Cyber Collective, and, you know, let's talk, because I can talk about this stuff all day long. I love it so much.
I love that. I'm telling you, after this podcast, not necessarily today, but I am going to reach out to you and talk to you about this, because I actually find this stuff really fascinating. I was actually a sociology major, believe it or not, many, 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 many years ago.
Let's go. And, I love sociology. You know,
Yeah, I love it. And the whole idea of just how you're perceived or self-perception based on society and societal norms, and now with this whole digitization element that you've thrown in there that I've never really thought about that deeply, that's really fascinating to me. So I promise you, once we're off the mic, we will continue that conversation. I want to move away from work completely right now and talk about what we do outside of work, because, you know, you and I both live in the greater New York City area. You're still in the city. I'm in Jersey, but we both appreciate what New York has to offer. When you are getting away from work completely and you're fulfilling yourself emotionally or recharging physically or even spiritually, maybe, what are some of the things that you find yourself doing to get to that place where you can really just forget about work completely?
I love this question, because forgetting about work is one of my favorite pastimes. I really try to implement that. Well, first, I do my best to step away and create healthy boundaries between me and my work. I, you know, recently realized, you know how people, I would be on podcasts and I'd be like, man, I just stay up all night thinking about this work. Like, I'm so passionate about it. And I couldn't relate, because I'd be like, right, there is nothing that is trying to keep me up at night, you know, outside of just wanting to sleep.
Right.
But I get it now in the passion that I have around Cyber Collective and the speaking engagements that I do, you know, all around the world. I have to kind of force myself to turn my brain off. And the way that the first step is shutting down technology and just stepping away from it, like I said. The second is my family. I have a niece and nephew. Well, I have multiple nephews, but younger niece and nephew. Right. And play. I have really tried to implement playing youthful, jovial joy things in my life. Card games, board games, playing tag outside, literally kickball with my friends. That is like really putting in joy into my life and laughing. I go to comedy shows at least once a week by myself. I thoroughly enjoy being alone.
That's amazing. Love that.
And I go into the city and I watch comedy, and I love stand up so much. And that's why, you know, I'm so funny. I don't know if anybody else is funny,
but I, you are.
So activities that can truly make you present. And I think playing and enjoying live action things like comedy or shows is awesome. And I know that the comedy thing and going to shows are kind of, not everybody can indulge in that from a time perspective and stuff, even my own family. So some of the things that I do at home, like I read a lot. I read so much. I don't know if you probably can't see, but I have just like stacks of
books
like
everywhere.
Books everywhere, all over my apartment. And I journal. I love to write. There are lots of thoughts in my head, and something that helps me turn off the thoughts in my head is by getting it out on paper. And it helps me just kind of do a word vomit. And then I can truly step away and enjoy whatever it is. And then lastly, eating food, man, my life it is rooted. Like I have one meal and then I'm like, what's the next meal about to be? Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And you're definitely in the right city for that. For anyone listening, we were actually going to do this interview in person, and we weren't able to make it happen this time. But one of the things I was looking forward to was a possible lunch post interview. So next time I come to New York Penn, I'm going to let you know, and maybe we can grab a lunch, because there's so much good food in the city. It's just ridiculous how much food is
there. It's ridiculous how much. And I'm in Queens, so I'm going to gatekeep. I don't want people coming to Queens, to be honest. No, I'm just kidding. Queens is good. Come to Queens. But there's a lot of good food in Queens. It is one of the most diverse cities in the world. There are over 280 languages spoken just within a 12-block radius of where I live, which is incredible. If you can't travel the world, you can see the world in Queens. And that is not a sponsored ad by any means, but if anybody in New York State or municipality of Queens is listening, I'm happy to be sponsored by any of you.
No, you're speaking the truth. I actually used to be a walking tour guide. I still have my license in New York City. And I mean, you can eat in a different restaurant in the city every night for 8 years and never repeat a restaurant. So, and even if they didn't close, even if they didn't switch. The diversity is in food and in culture is really unparalleled. And one day we will take advantage of that. But on that note, I think this is a perfect place to bookend this amazing conversation. Taz, thank you so much for making time and having this chat today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I loved it. I'm going to need to bring you onto the Security Stories podcast next, so that I can get to know you better. And I am so excited to really, I'm probably going to set something on your calendar and meet up next week or something. Cause why not? We're here.
Yeah. Let's do it. I mean, I would be more than happy to participate in that. So I appreciate the thought. Well, listen, have a great day. And I know we will connect again soon.
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Take care.